listening to the Parliament of Rooks podcast, episode 1, Origins and Omens. That old black magic's got me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well. Those icy fingers up and down my spine. The same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. So welcome, everyone, to the Parliament of Rooks podcast, your guide to all things supernatural in the DC universe. I'm your host, Thomas Lanise, and with me tonight, and hopefully going forward, if she doesn't run away screaming at the prospect of reviewing a bunch of comic books, is my wife of 16 years, Melanie.
Hello!
So right off the bat, you're probably wondering what's up with our title. What is a Parliament of Rooks? Well, if you're a fan of the old Neil Gaiman Sandman series from the early 90s, you might recognize it as a story within a story that was told by one of the characters, Kane, the proprietor of the House of Mystery. And basically the story he told described the strange behavior of a group of black birds called rooks, similar to crows or ravens. And
a member of the Cordovae family.
Yeah, exactly. And what these birds would do is basically land in a field in a circle around a single member of the flock, and for a period of time, an hour or more, sometimes from dusk till dawn, I think it said, these birds would surround the single member and listen to him caw and crow. At which point, one of two things would happen. Either A, collectively the whole group would get up and fly away, or B, they would all turn on that single member and peck him to death.
It was vicious.
But the twist of the story, you know, as you find out at the end, is what's happening is that that single bird in the center is actually a storyteller, and the group surrounding them is judging the merits of his story, you know, and if they like it, then great, all right, we're going to stay a group and all fly away together. But if they didn't like it, that's like, all right, dead. Yeah. But even if you are familiar with that story, you know, you're probably wondering, well, what does that have to do with this podcast? Well, as I mentioned at the forefront, you know, what this is intended to be is a historical overview of all things magic and supernatural in the DC universe. As you might well imagine, there's quite a few stories going to be associated with that, and a little bit of background between myself and Melanie here. I am fairly familiar with those stories, and Melanie, how many of them have you read?
I think almost zero now.
Well, that's not entirely true. You know, you've read... you know, or rather, you know, you had me read to you, you know, a couple issues of Promethea, right? The old Alan Moore comic.
So is that like cheating if you read it to me?
No, it's storytelling, as we say, you know. yeah, I think it's fair to say that in our family, I am definitely the comic reader.
Yeah, I would say so.
But that being said, it's not as though your interests lie entirely outside the realm of fantasy fiction. You know, I know you, you know, you're quite a fan of, you know, some of those more sword and sorcery type like films and TV shows and stuff, right?
Yeah, I think I've always really liked them. I remember there was a whole series of movies like based on Greek mythology, like Jason and the Argonauts, and I love that kind of, I mean, it's not sword and sorcery, but that's what grabbed me first into fantasy.
Oh, like those, I know what you're talking about. You're talking like those old Robert Helmy things. Like, I think they did, what, Odyssey with, what was the name of it? Like, Armand Asante, and I think they did Merlin with Sam Neill, right?
You know what? Laugh all you want at, you know, like, little TV miniseries kind of things, but I love that one. I think it's awesome. and there's also... there's movies like Lord of the Rings, which, you know, both of us like that so much. We actually named our dog after it.
Your dog's, our dog's named Lord of the Rings?
No. His name is Pippin, as you know. And he knows that we're talking about him now. we named our dog Pippin, and because it totally fit him. He's always getting into trouble.
And he's got hairy feet.
And he has hairy feet, yes.
So, given the fact that, you know, Melanie... has, you know, has an interest in sword and sorcery and fantasy fiction, you know, but for the most part, the comics world is fairly new ground for her. In a sense, you know, what I'm hoping is to have happen is that she almost acts as a proxy, you know, for the audience, you know, who might be unfamiliar with these stories as well. So relating that to our title, Parliament of Rooks, in a sense, she's the parliament and I'm the rook. You know, basically I'm reading these stories and she's acting as judge.
More than that, I'm judge, jury, and executioner.
Lovely.
Execution-er.
I'm gonna execute you.
Well, if you tell me good stories, there won't be a need for you to do that.
Well, believe it or not, that's actually a perfect place to segue into the type of stories that we are going to be covering in this podcast then. Like I mentioned at the forefront, you know, basically this podcast, we're going to be doing a historical overview of all things supernatural in the DC universe. You know, the DC universe at this point basically spans 80 years. You know, so what are we going to be covering? Like you and I had talked about, DC universe, you know, for convenience sake, could sort of be divided into what they call ages.
Like the golden, silver, and like what's bronze age?
Yeah, no, exactly. So, you know, in one form or another, we're basically going to cover all of it. Going all the way back to, you know, the golden age, as you say.
Wait, hold on.
What
exactly is the golden age? Because I know that I just said golden age and silver
age. Yeah,
and...
okay. So golden age, you know, in like if you want to just give it a, it sort of sandwiches World War II. DC Comics began in 1935. And Golden Age was basically, you know, those wartime comics, you know, running from there through about, I'd say, you know, 1948 or so when superhero comics were on the wane. You know, so during that time period, like I say, from a supernatural perspective, DC, you would generally see three types of characters. You know, you'd either have sort of like stage magicians, you know, kind of like in the Mandrake the Magician tradition.
Okay.
You know, a couple of characters that, as the podcast goes on, we'll delve into all these more deeply. But, you know, people like Zatara the Magician or like Sargon the Sorcerer. That would be type one supernatural character. Type two, and actually one of the very first characters from DC that was recurring, you know, would be in a second vein I would term as like, say, supernatural detective. And that'd be somebody like Dr. Occult, basically, you know, a trench coat wearing guy who goes out and solves magic related crimes. You know, you would actually really like it. It kind of reminds me of that show Supernatural that used to be on. So he'd go out and like find vampires or werewolves and whatever, and like, you know,
sounds great.
Yeah, hunt them. Yeah, you'll love it. But then the third thing I would say from the Golden Age would be the superhero-inspired magic characters. Two of the big ones, and you're definitely going to see those, you know, just a couple weeks out from now, would be Dr. Fate and the Spectre. Like I say, they're more in the superhero vein. You know, they have costumes, spandexy type things, but very influenced by sort of elder god fiction by like H.P. Lovecraft, that type thing. You know, you'd see in the Golden Age a lot of references to, you know, these demons and, you know, like I say, you know, sort of eldritch magic, you know.
Scary.
So all that being said, you know, we are going to make a lot of reference to the Golden Age, but for the most part, stories that we cover from then, we're basically going to be doing as inserts into the overall narrative. The reason being is that, you know, a lot of them, given the fact that they were very production oriented, tend to be somewhat repetitive. You know, trust me, you don't want to read 100 different Zatara stories because they're basically all the same.
Oh, joy.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to get executed. That's all I'm saying.
No. So where I was thinking it would be best for us to start would probably be in the Silver Age.
Which is what?
So basically after the Golden Age, there was actually a rather significant backlash to comics. There was a psychologist by the name of Dr. Frederick Wortham. I was going to say, right, you bought me Seduction of the Innocent.
Kinky.
Yeah, right.
or not.
Yeah, trust me, or not. because basically his contention was that, you know, comic books were contributing to the juvenile delinquency of children. And so they had, you know, big hearings and Senate subcommittee, so on and so forth. And the net result of it was such that, you know, a new authority was introduced, the Comics Code Authority, which basically, any comic had to pass muster in order to be put out there. And so the net effect of it, you know, was basically comics got very sanitized. So a lot of these more supernatural elements were just banned altogether. So when I say Silver Age, you know, what we're talking about basically is the 1950s through mid-1960s. Right in the aftermath of, you know, the Comics Code Authority. And like I say, a little more juvenile in you know, in their
would you say cartoony?
Well, I don't know so much cartoon, but definitely geared more toward children, you know, as you'll see as we get into the story tonight. So as an overview, like I say, Silver Age, some of the things that we're going to be talking about during that, and that's going to occupy, you know, the next, you know, few episodes or so, are going to be some actually really classic stories. You know, I mentioned Zatara, so we're actually going to meet his daughter, Zatanna, which is a fantastic story called Zatanna's Search. And that actually spans several different titles. You know, they introduce his daughter, and she crosses over into like five or six different superhero stories. You're really going to like it. You know, some of the other things we'll talk about are some more obscure things, like, you know, Eclipso, or like, you know, The Enchantress.
Really?
Yeah.
Eclipso?
Yeah, you'll like it. But actually, no, something that you're really going to like is Stanley and His Monster. It's almost like if you can imagine like Calvin and Hobbes. But instead of Hobbes being a tiger, he's actually a demon kicked out of hell. It's definitely played for laughs, but it's, you know, it's really classic stuff. So like I said, you know, we'll cover the Silver Age until about, you know, 1966, 67. And then we're getting into the Bronze Age, which is really where the supernatural side of DC kicks into high gear. There was an editor named Joe Orlando, who was, you know, the head of the whole supernatural line of DC Comics, and you know, that's when they really started reintroducing a lot of more spooky elements, you know, and that's where Kane, we mentioned from, you know, the Parliament of Rooks story, was one of the first characters, you know, introduced there as a sort of horror host. Like, if you can almost imagine, like, the Crypt Keeper, you know?
Oh, that was goofy.
Yeah, it was goofy, right? But he was like, he would be the person who would introduce, you know, the horror story about to begin, and so too was Kane. And like his brother Abel, and then they had like, you know, the three witches and Judge Gallows, just like a whole line of people like this. But then really more like serious type stories. Like one of my favorite characters from this the Bronze Age would be Deadman.
I heard you mention that.
It's basically, he's a circus aerialist. Check it out. He's a circus aerialist that's been shot.
Check it out.
And killed. Right? Mm. But comes back as a ghost to hunt his killer. So if you can imagine, it's almost like The Fugitive. It's almost exactly like The Fugitive, really, because he's actually on the hunt for a one-armed man who shot him. He's got a hook for a hand. So that's a classic storyline that we're going to be covering, you know, Dead Man and the Hunt for the Hook.
Awesome.
And then something that you're going to love is this this series called The Wrath of the Spectre. It's actually from the early 70s, I want to say. I'll double check that. But a writer named Michael T. Fleischer revisited one of those golden age superhero characters, but recast him in just such a vicious, vicious role. He would hunt down killers and just basically brutally give them retribution. You know, he would turn them into wax, you know, and then melt them.
Oh,
or
wow.
He would turn them into wood and then slice them up. You know,
it's... Oh, wow. That's pretty evil.
Oh, you're going to dig it. And some of the other things I want to hit from the Bronze Age would be some things you might be peripherally familiar with. There's a classic run by the writer-artist Jack Kirby. You've probably heard the name.
Yep.
Right. So he did a character called the Demon, which is basically a man who can summon up a demon from inside him. Basically, this demon possesses him, but by saying a certain rhyme, he turns into that creature, and then allows him to like roam free.
Huh.
Yeah, you'll really like it. And then, of course, you would probably only know it from the more cheesy movies or whatever, but a great character that will cover his intro in the 70s, but then, like, you know, his absolute classic run from the 80s will be the Swamp Thing. I see Melanie's looking at me askance, you know, because she's thinking rubber suit. But no, seriously, it's Alan Moore, which you know from...
From your drawing upstairs.
Well, not from my drawing, but the Alphabets
of Lettering.
Alphabets of Desire. We have a print hanging in our house or whatever that was a collaboration from Alan Moore and Todd Klein. But yeah, you're absolutely going to love Swamp Thing. But all of that, like I say, the really, really good Bronze Age stuff is going to have to wait because we are going to start in the Silver Age.
Okay,
so just to put a line in the sand then, the very first story that we're going to cover from the Silver Age is going to be Justice League of America number 2 from December 1960, January 1961. And just give you a little background, like I say, because, you know, I know you're not familiar with these characters or even, you know, the history of comics that much. Just to place this into context, we're looking at the cover of the issue right now, and you see the very first thing that jumps out at you is up in the right-hand corner, you see that little stamp.
Yep.
Approved by the Comics Code Authority. So like I was saying, this would have been post that era, you know, of the, you know, the Senate subcommittee hearings on juvenile delinquency. So what you're going to get basically is a type of story that is really geared more toward a juvenile audience, and from which, you know, any of the more, you know, salacious elements, shall we say, you know, have been removed. One of the things that I've gone ahead and, you know, pulled up just to sort of give an example of how sanitized things have become is what I consider to be, you know, almost an earlier,
precursor,
yeah, like an artistic influence, if you will, you know, for this cover. So what we're looking at here, you know, on the right is the cover for Justice League of America number 2. And what you see is, you know, a bunch of superheroes. Some of these you may be familiar with. Matter of fact, let me just start off by giving you a little bit of background on who the Justice League is. They're a superhero team of the early Silver Age that was formed by all of the main superheroes being published at that time. You had your big... let's call them the Big Four. Basically, what you would recognize as, I'm guessing, probably the Super Friends. You know, so that would be like Superman, Batman,
Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman, right? And Aquaman. And the reason that they would have been included in this first team is because they never stopped being published. These were actually Golden Age characters, you know, from the World War II era that had been continuously published. A lot of the other superheroes, like I mentioned, had sort of gone to the wayside. So back in the day, you know, you had what would have been like a Golden Age version of the Flash and a Golden Age version of the Green Lantern, but they had long since stopped being published. But then, you know, in the early 50s, there was a lot of science fiction influence, you know, coming into DC. A lot of the writers, you know, formerly from science fiction pulp magazines were suddenly coming across. And they wanted to reimagine a lot of those characters, but in a newly science fiction type way. So, you know, like, so for instance, this character here in the lower left-hand corner, you know, who do you think that is?
Well, it looks like Flash.
Flash, exactly. Right. So, but this is the Silver Age Flash. Basically, there is somebody, you know, from the 1930s that was also called Flash, but this guy, you know, now has a sci-fi type origin. He was basically a police chemist, almost like, you can imagine him almost like a CSI type agent.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and he got his powers, you know, in an accident with a lightning strike on some chemicals. You know, and this guy up in the upper left.
Green Lantern?
Green Lantern, exactly. Once again, he's the Silver Age Green Lantern. There was an earlier guy in the 30s who was also Green Lantern, but this guy's origin is more science fiction. Basically, an alien came down and granted him his scientific ring as opposed to a magic ring.
Yeah.
Right. And then this other fellow who is, you know, slamming against the door, you might not recognize,
no,
him, a little bit more obscure. He's known as the Martian Manhunter.
Never heard of him.
They introduced him, I think, you know, almost as a one-off at one point. You know, it was a story about there was a scientist who had devised a teleportation device, and he accidentally teleported this man from Mars, but then died, and so he's sort of stuck here.
That's a hell of an accident.
Yeah, I know, right?
Oops.
Yeah, so he has, he's adopted a, you know, an identity here and, you know, fights crime. But basically, so the Justice League, you know, and if you want to think in terms of characters being re-envisioned, this team, in a sense, is re-envisioned because, or reimagined, I should say, because in the 1940s, there was a superhero team called the Justice Society. So this now is the Silver Age version of a Golden Age team, so on and so forth. So there you got your big seven: Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, Green Lantern, Flash, and the Martian Manhunter. And go ahead.
How was the audience reacting to this?
Oh, they ate it up. You know,
really?
Because they used to have an idea in comics publishing, which said that every issue is somebody's first. You know, basically they weren't expecting, you know, the way things are in the modern day, you know, where people would be comic fans for 20, 30 years. You know, no, every 5 or 6 years, you have a whole new crop of children. So they had no idea about, you know, characters from World War II. These were kids in, you know, in the late 1950s who were like, oh my gosh, you know, brand new superheroes. You know, they thought it was the greatest thing on earth. And to put all these superheroes into a team, That was even better. Now, to your point, you want to talk about, you know, the audience for it. As we're going to see, we get into it. So I've mentioned the seven superheroes. There's actually an eighth character who was a recurrent character in the Justice League, who was sort of almost their mascot. And you could almost...
Gleek, no.
There was no monkeys back then, at least not in the Justice League.
Not yet.
But no, but you're going to love it. What he is actually a young man who is, I guess he's supposed to be like a hep cat. He sort of talks in like, yeah, in like 1950s slang and such. Oh, and his name his nickname, I should say, is Snapper Carr. Because he's always snapping and popping his fingers or whatever, but talking in hep cat lingo. So in any case, all of that is just background for you so you know who the team is that we're dealing with. So they are the Justice League. But the reason we're taking a look at the cover first is, as I say, the design of this cover, you know, basically we see five of the seven, you know, Superman and Batman aren't here, but the other five are basically doing their best to hold a metal door that is opening from the sky closed, through which these demonic hands, these demonic clawed hands, are, you know, reaching out into our world, and they're trying to shut it. So now I've pulled up next to it, if you look, an earlier comic cover from, I believe it's 1953, yeah, June of 1953, which is actually The Phantom Stranger number 6. And if you look, the thing noticeably absent on that cover is...
The stamp,
exactly. This was pre-code. And if you look, this is almost the exact same design. We see the Phantom Stranger and, you know, a little, a damsel in distress trying to hold this door in the sky open as these demonic hands are reaching through it. But if you look, I would almost describe these as a little more sinister, evil. There's definitely the threat level is higher in this.
And if you look, like this, the older one is over a city, whereas the JLA one is, it's got like a tree branch there. So it seems like it's far away from society. So the older one is far more threatening.
Oh, that's a really good, I didn't even think of that. That's a really good point. Yeah, so we're exactly right. There's a greater imminent threat, you know, as this demon that could possibly end human lives, whereas here they're more isolated. A really good point. But now the really interesting thing is I was taking a look at the art credits. Guess what? The artist on each of these, exactly the same. They are both done by a very famous artist by the name of Murphy Anderson. He basically cannibalized himself, from Phantom Stranger number 6, you know, and then 7 years later, basically used almost the exact same cover design on JLA number 2.
Does the JLA stuff, does that stay red, white, and blue?
No, I think that from issue to issue that varies. It's just a color scheme. Maybe they started with red, white, and blue, but yeah, definitely sometimes yellow and black, just different colors, I believe.
And at the bottom of this one, they're really looks like fans of alliteration here. It says a star-studded spectacular secret of the sinister. Wow, secret of the sinister sorcerers. That is a mouthful.
Oh no, absolutely. The editors of Silver Age DC Comics, if nothing else, absolute carnival barkers. You know, they would try everything under the sun to sell an issue. They had a whole bag full of tricks, like some of the things, you know, that, and you probably see some of these as we go from issue to issue, but a real prevalence of gorillas. it's so ridiculous, right? But what happened is they would have a gorilla on a cover and it would sell well. And, you know, and the editors would go, well, clearly the secret to selling a lot of comics is gorillas.
Yes, clearly.
And so then they would push out tons of gorilla covers. Or someone crying, they found sold. You know, so you'd see a lot of comics with somebody crying. And now...
I'll have to see an example of that. That seems weird.
This cover?
Yeah.
The color purple. They found that when the back...
So I was wondering about that because it seems to me that, you know, barring the background color, which is kind of like more like a fuchsia... They're definitely skewing toward a little boy audience. What would you say the target age is? Like 11?
Yeah, I'm speculating here, but yeah, I would imagine maybe 10 to 12. Or I would even go maybe younger, maybe like, you know, let's say 8 to 12, I would think, you know, might be the target audience.
Yeah, but I mean, this is all very, like, male skewed, except for that, like, hot pink background.
Yeah, right. So, but like I say, absolutely, this was one of their go-tos. Huh. You know, a purplish background, you know, they found was, you know, something that sold comics. You know, so that is where we begin. All right. So first things first, in the credit where credit is due department, as Melanie mentioned, this is the Secret of the Sinister Sorcerers. This was written by Gardner Fox with pencils by Mike Sikowski and inks by Bernard Sachs. Letters by Gaspar Saladino and colors, unfortunately, unknown. And I say unfortunately because, as we'll see, you know, in just a couple pages. In my opinion, some absolutely magnificent coloring. Cover, already mentioned, was Murphy Anderson, inking himself with letters by Ira Schnapp. All right, so we open to the first page and a little bit of background on some of the conventions of comics. I just want to clarify, oftentimes in the Silver Age, what you'll see on the first page isn't actually a story page proper. It's more a sort of symbolic representation of what's on the inside. They call this a splash page because it's generally a single image and attempts to capture your attention by saying, you know, what's going to go on in here. So what we see is, you know, our big seven in, you know, sort of shadowy type yellows, and they're around a cauldron. And
is that Batman?
In the back, yeah.
That's kind of goofy.
Yeah, that actually, yeah, so this would actually be pre-TV series. So yeah, they don't even have the yellow circle. I think you're going to find maybe some of this art is a little bit wonky. Mike Sikowski, you know, is a classic Silver Age artist, but a lot of his you know, anatomy designs leave a little something to be desired, in my opinion. But so we see our main blurb. Crime fighters beyond compare, foes of all evil. Where there comes from land, sea, or air, enemies of injustice and the terror of all wrongdoers, these are the members of the Justice League of America. Suddenly, the superheroes find the Earth has become a world of chaos, where nothing scientific works and only magic holds sway. To come to grips with the evil menace responsible for this disaster, the Justice League must find the doorway to Magic Land.
Oh, to Magic Land.
Exactly. Like I say, very, very much kiddie-oriented.
That's awesome.
So we see the roll call in order of their appearance. Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, Flash, John Jones, who is the Martian Manhunter. That's
his Martian name. Oh, okay. I was just going to ask
who that was. Yeah. Aquaman, Batman, and Superman.
Well, who's the green dude?
Well, let's read.
No, you have to tell me.
So in the splash page, we see Flash and Green Lantern stirring the cauldron, as Flash says that he feels ridiculous trying to work magic like this. But Aquaman, you know, upbraids him, saying, "Silly or not, Flash, the spell is working. Look, we've summoned up Merlin, the most famous magician of all time, to help us."
I was wondering who the green guy was.
Yeah, well, so as a fan of the Halmy films, you should definitely appreciate the fact that we have Merlin making an appearance. All right, so we've been our story proper at the annual Magic Society convention, where Mandini the Mage is performing a feat in legerdemain.
Mandini.
Well, exactly right. So I mentioned Mandrake the Magician from the newspaper comics. Take a look. Our magician here looks almost exactly cut from that cloth.
Very
pencil thin mustache, and you know, very traditional tuxedoed costume.
Yep.
And he's saying that that tonight, in honor of our special guest Green Lantern, he's going to form a living human being out of smoke. So he casts a spell. Blue smoke, gray smoke, white smoke swirl. Fetch me now a living girl.
Oh, and we get I Dream of Jeannie.
Yeah, right. She's got the harem pants and the whole nine yards. Now just pause just real quick to take a look at the coloring. As I mentioned, I'm really a fan of what's going on here. You know, you see a lot of oranges and yellows, and what's this suggesting is they're in the dark, right? Not a traditional coloring scheme, but it absolutely conveys that. So after our girl appears, you know, Mandini turns to the audience and, you know, states that ordinarily magicians don't explain their tricks, but, you know, because Green Lantern's there, he's going to reveal how this one was done. And what he says is that concealed beneath the smoke is a trapdoor. Permit me to demonstrate. But when he goes to lift the trapdoor, it's locked. His assistant yells out, "Mandini, wait, don't try your magic stunt yet. The trapdoor is locked. I've misplaced the key." Cries of amazement burst through the lips of the onlookers. "But if the trapdoor was locked, how do you do the trick?" And Mandini muses, "I don't know. It's almost as if I did it with real magic." And in the background, we see Green Lantern just ignoring the entirety of it while he tests the electric switch.
Yeah, really.
He's noticing that it's odd. He's throwing the switch off and on, but nothing's happening. And as we turn to the next page, it looks like the electricity in the magic convention is pretty much the least of the worries, because at that moment, an eerie hush is falling across an entire Earth. Neither in city nor country, nor on land, nor air, nor sea, does any man-made invention perform its function. And we sort of have a tableau of some of our Justice League members. We see Wonder Woman here in her identity as Diana Prince. She's trying to talk to Steve Trevor, her boyfriend, but no, the phone's gone dead. Then we see the Flash trying to return his costume to his, you don't know this, but he's got a compressor ring where he basically stores his costume.
Of course he does.
but no, the Flash costume's not returned to the ring. And John Jones, who, secret identity is actually a police investigator. Mm-hmm. And, but suddenly the motor conked out. We go down, we see Aquaman out at sea is trying to rescue a sailor whose engine has gone dead. Batman's finding that a single object in his utility belt works. And, we see a girl looks from the Steno pool or whatever, coming up to Clark Kent, secretly Superman, saying that the telegraph wire must be down somewhere. I can't send your story to the Daily Planet. And now here's our beatnik,
Snapper car
falls victim to an unusual catastrophe as he's doing some film developing, apparently. Man, this is a real drag. I'll never get these pictures for the school yearbook developed now. So the full realization hits everybody, but nevertheless, even in spite of the apparent power failure, the Justice League members decide that they're going to try to contact each other by means of their emergency signal. So across the board, you see Wonder Woman activating hers from her little headband, and Flash on his belt, and Superman from his chest emblem. And they're thinking, probably our emergency signals aren't going to work either, but we've got to try. Maybe the others will respond. But at this very moment, in another world, who do we see?
Merlin.
That's right. Merlin the Magician attempting a mystical incantation. Apparently, both he and Mandini know the rule of magic is to rhyme. Because he's saying, skin of frog and blood of bat, ear of dog and fur of cat, spirits of the astral plane, send us now our springtime rain. Long live Jambi.
Jambi?
Jambi the and his, to his stunned amazement, the sky continues uncloudy and the sun brightly shines as an underling comes up. What's wrong, Merlin? I've hired you. Oh, not an underling. I'm sorry. His patron, apparently. What's wrong, Merlin? I've hired you to bring rain so our crops can grow in Magic Land.
Magic Land.
I don't know, sire. Suddenly, a strange and thunderous noise draws the attention of the great magician and the king of Magic Land. Who comes on the road to Camelot? What are those strange horseless chariots they ride? Look yonder, your majesty. And thundering down the road, we see what look to be three, early era 1960s, muscle cars, coupe de villes or whatnot, rumbling down. And we see they're driven by apparently three bad guys. Simon Magus, the evil magician, Saturna, lord of misrule, and the troll king. So Merlin lifts his arms to try to banish the evil trio. Begone, foul spirits of Netherland, by air and sun and the glory hand. But Simon Magus says, save your breath, Merlin. Magic doesn't work in this land anymore, thanks to us. 4 weeks ago, on All Hallows' Eve, we three did perform a magical incantation, and by our spells put a golden doorway in the sky. So we see a little flashback, and that's right, they created a doorway, the doorway we saw on the cover,
yep,
I'm assuming.
Yep, creepy hand.
Right. And soon, going through, they found themselves in a fantastic world where people use conveyances called autos and airplanes instead of winged horses and flying carpets to carry them about. What they discovered is basically our land.
Mm-hmm.
As they say, a land based on scientific law, not magic lore like ours. Almost a comment, if you will, on the tenor of DC Comics at the time. Right? Sci-fi influence as opposed to magic. So what they do is they spend many days in this other world learning much of its science and returning to Magic Land, consulting ancient magical books. They cast a spell basically to co-opt our technology through space and time with reed and rhyme. Let battle proceed to serve our need. And they conjure up, Chrysler LeBaron or whatnot. Yeah, which actually I'm having difficulty identifying the way this car works. Doesn't that look like a hood ornament? Actually, like
it
on
does,
the trunk.
It's on the back.
It's very odd.
Yeah, and like they look like headlights.
Yeah. So anyway, long story short, they conjure up a vehicle, and that was just the beginning. So because many times they worked their magic until the day came when they were ready to perform the mightiest feat of black magic ever known. Simon Magus says, geographically, the world called Earth is a duplicate of this world called Magic Land. Our scheme is to transpose Earth into our magic dimension. He's looking at a map, and basically North and South America have been, in their magic land, it's called Asgard. And it looks like, Europe and Africa are called Olympia. So what we're seeing here, this is actually super interesting. I said at the beginning, the writer is a guy named Gardner Fox. One of the major things that he's going to be doing for the DC Universe in just a couple of years is introducing the whole concept of parallel Earths, where we see our Justice League existing on, a certain Earth, and then you're going to see in just a couple episodes, there's going to be another Earth, Earth 2, where all the Golden Age characters live. So there's like duplicates of like the Flash will meet the Golden Age Flash, and the Green Lantern will meet the Golden Age Green Lantern.
Oh, neat.
But the writer, Gardner Fox, is the same writer of this story. So in a sense, this is actually the introduction of the entire concept of parallel Earths, because we see it looks exactly like Earth. It just happens to be called Magic Land as opposed to like a numbered Earth 1, Earth 2. So good stuff. But anyway, Simon Magus, he's got this evil plan. He's going to transpose the science from our place into Magic Land, and then the magic, from his land into the science dimension. As he says, since both worlds are in exactly the same sector in space, no one will know the difference until it's too late. So for a day and a night, they summon the fiends of the Netherland to do their biddings by a secret incantation, which each of them held. Oh, of which each of them held a third. And they called upon their awesome powers. Worlds in space you shall derange, Earth for magic land exchange. So time goes on, and one by one, the treasures of the magic world are kept for safety in Fable Camelot are carried off. The goose that lays the golden eggs, the flying horse Pegasus, the fairy gold that disappears at dawn, then reappears, the sword Excalibur now belong to us. So basically, they rob the king. Meanwhile, at the secret headquarters of the Justice League, members are footsore and weary from their long journey. Ah, because they actually had to go there, right?
Yeah, by foot.
Because nothing man-made worked. As Flash says, I see our superpowers failed along with everything else. Even these matches don't work. And Green Lantern, bemoans his situation. Nothing man-made is functioning. We've got to determine what has caused all this. Which sort of begs the question, like, man-made. I mean, that couch is working.
Yeah. And honestly, I don't see why a bicycle wouldn't work.
Exactly. Yeah, really. But why does Flash's power not work? Like, is that man-made if it's been I don't know. In any case, Snapper Carr, busting out some hipster lingo, says, "We'll be on cloud nine in a jiff, fellas, as soon as our wick sticks get lit up."
Wick sticks.
How do we start finding out what's behind all this? Green Lantern says, I have a clue. So, the Emerald Gladiator, as he's known, relates his strange experience at the Magic Society. And so he's claiming that it's possible that the only thing that will work on Earth right now is magic. And Superman says, come to think of it, that's one of the things that robs me of my superpowers, a magic spell. And Wonder Woman says, that sounds incredible, but it's worth investigating. Let's go to our library. And so they go to their library, with ancient tomes, it looks like.
And apparently they need a candle because their lights aren't working.
Once again, is that candle not man-made?
Yeah, so where is the line?
Where's the line drawn? But in any case, Wonder Woman claims that they've stored up all of Earth's knowledge, in their library, and she directs Snapper Carr to the magic section, to which he responds, "Man, we ought to be able to jet up and go with this print mint to help size up this situation."
Wow. Oh
So,
my God.
Yeah. So Wonder Woman reads from an ancient book of sorcery. Member after member tosses a certain ingredient into the witch's brew. Oh, so this is good. I know that you've got a little bit of background in herbalism. So see if you can
No,
tell me if
no.
any of this is. Oil of hen's mane? Is that anything?
Not that I'm familiar with.
Yeah. Powder. Oh, maybe this is not
No, bat
herbalism.
wings, no,
Yeah, okay.
cats, whiskers, these don't grow on plants.
Really, you and your witchy friends don't do any of this
Mummified
stuff?
foot of frog.
You've never mummified a foot of a frog? I find that hard to believe. So, as they're tossing all this in, Flash, calls back his thing from the splash page. I feel kind of silly doing this, and Green Lantern says, so do I, but we've got to give magic a chance. So Superman pours out the brew, and the firm, clear tones of Wonder Woman speak the incantation. Out of earth and out of fire, from air and sea and all things dire, produce for us a blue sapphire.
Sweet. I need that one.
So the red smoke vanishes, and in its place, Sapphire is in fact created. But what do they do next? And Wonder Woman, brightly faced, says that they need to use this to summon up the mightiest magician of all, Merlin. So once again, they mix up another brew, and they shred some rare herbs. Snapperkar digs this magic bit. It's crazy. And they add some powdered cinque foil.
Never heard of it.
And Marmaritan leaves?
Again.
No, okay. These might just be some eldritch magic herbs. And so out of the smoke, who arises? But of course, Merlin, completely befuddled. Where am I? Who dares transport Merlin out of Magic Land? But the Justice League quickly explain their situation, and they tell him what the deal is. And it suddenly becomes clear. So that's the answer to the mystery. Earth is now in the magic dimension, and their powers only work in the science dimension. And that means that their assignment is to cross over to the science dimension, overcome the Troll King, Simon Magus, and Saturna, and recover from each the third of the magical incantations, which will restore Earth and Magic Land to normal. And Aquaman says that's easier said than done. But Merlin can help. Remember, we're now in the magic dimension where all his powers will work. And this is what you're going to see is a very standard trope. So, basically, we've had the introduction, and now they're going to go off on their separate missions, and invariably, they split up into teams. And so Martian Manhunter says, "Suppose Green Lantern and I go after Saturna." And Flash says, "Wonder Woman and I will seek out the Troll King." And Superman says, "And the rest of us will handle Simon Magus." So, once again, in sepulchral tones, the Mighty Mage speaks the incantation, which sends the JLA members hurtling into Magic Land. Fly east, fly west, fly south, fly north. Fly members of the Justice League, go forth. And Snapper says, as they disappear, "They're gone, real gone."
Yeah.
And Merlin, left alone with Snapper, says, "Perhaps now my magic will be of some use in your world, young man." "You're just brain t or was it now you're brain talking, Merlin? I'm just the cat who can clue you in on what you want to know." In that case, let's sally forth." Merlin busts out some hipster lingo of his own. And a little, wandy action. And before we know it, the carpet becomes, as Snapper calls it, a rug with jet attachments. Or, in other words, as Merlin says, a flying carpet.
Okay.
And off they go into the wild blue yonder. So, Secret of the Sinister Sorcerers, Chapter 2. As we open and read our little caption, hurled through space and time by the incantation of Merlin the Magician, Green Lantern and John Jones find themselves before the secret hideout of Saturna, Lord of Misrule. Crashing through the bronze doors which guard his secret caverns in the Magic Land continent of Asgard, they burst into the lair of the fabled Manticore and the Griffin. We see two quite vile monsters guarding this. The Manticore leaps toward Green Lantern, and the beast tail whips about and sends a shower of blue needles straight for the Emerald Warrior. Green Lantern's thinking, the Manticore's yellow body. Oh, a little bit of background before we get into it. Green Lantern, obviously can form little shapes from his power ring, but it does have one weakness. He's powerless against the color yellow.
Oh, well, that is going to be a problem.
That's going to be a problem because as he's thinking, the Manticore's yellow body protects it from my power ring, and even if one of those blue needles scratches my skin, it will paralyze me. And at this very same moment, the great golden talons of the Griffin grab the Martian Manhunter and lift him upward. But whatever, because Martian Manhunter thinks this half-lion, half-eagle will be no match for my Martian super strength. Just in time, Green Lantern lifts his power ring and pop, 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 pop. He harmlessly explodes the needles, leaving just the Manticore itself leaping for him. But his human strength is no match for that fabled creature as Green Lantern's hurled backwards. John Jones applies his titanic strength against the Griffin. A mighty pillar of red fire erupts from the cavern floor. Pause to let you know that, well, guess what Martian Manhunter's one weakness is?
Fire.
Bingo. Bingo. So, oh, those flames are weakening me, sapping me of my super strength. I'm going to fall. And fall he does, as the fire spirals up and down, the pillar of fire making him weaker and weaker. Meanwhile, Green Lantern is desperately fighting against the yellow-bodied... Yellow and fire.
It's like a perfect storm. What if he shuts his eyes?
It doesn't matter. It's an impurity in the ring itself. Visual component is...
So if the ring is present with yellow, then...
No good.
Huh.
Yeah. So, but sometimes he uses it, as he does here, almost, you know, indirectly, because a verdant beam from his power ring hits the wall and rebounds to form a mighty hand, which propels the JLA member and the Manticore across the cavern at terrific speed. And as it does so, knocks them out cold as they hit the wall of the thing. So you see, the green ring didn't have to affect yellow at all, just by proxy. So let's see if John comes up with something similar. He's got just enough strength to snatch up some dirt and gravel off the floor and fling it into the eyes of the griffin. Momentarily blinded, the beast flies wildly away from the fire. As it does so, you know, the distance causes Martian Manhunter's strength to increase, and you know, the farther away the griffin flies. So he's got to act fast before it circles back. And act fast he does, because just seconds later, his super muscles send the griffin flying skyward. And by the time it recovers from the trip he's sending it on, Martian Manhunter thinks Green Lantern and I will have completed our task here in Asgard. Flame Pillar dies out, and the JLA duo races in the cavern where Saturna has taken shelter. What was that pillar of fire anyway? It must be a natural phenomenon recurring at regular intervals, like the geysers at Yellowstone Park. So, and there sits Saturna, you know, cursing them. You managed to slip past my guards, but this is as far as you go. And instantly, the Lord of Misrule fires his twin atomic cannon. But the Emerald Gladiator lifts his power ring and changes those atomic projectiles into handcuffs. Saturna flings his third of the magic formula into a brazier, I think it's pronounced, of hot coals, basically like a hibachi.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But as the green manacles slip over his wrist, Saturna sees Martian Manhunter using his super breath, saying that he can't use his superpowers near those flaming coals, but by standing at a distance and using his breath, he can blow the paper to safety. And waha! They have captured Saturna, just like that. So as Green Lantern says, let's hope the other Justice Leaguers can handle the Troll King and Simon Magus, as John says, and get the rest of the incantation so we can restore Earth and Magic Land to their proper place in time and space. Uh-oh, he rhymed.
Mm-hmm, he did.
I hope that's not a magic spell. Alrighty. So, Secret of the Sinister Sorcerers, Chapter 3.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you see a pattern developing?
Yes.
Once again, we have two heroes, and, you know, they're on their little mission. So.
They might be giants.
They might. They might at that. Deep in the interior of the second continent of Magicland, called Olympia, stands the castle of the dreaded Troll King. Guarded by his giants, the Troll Monarch has proved invincible to every attack in the past. Can even those mighty members of the Justice League of America, Flash and Wonder Woman, conquer him?
Speaking of Flash, look at those granny panties.
Where?
Right there. Her little star granny panties.
Why do you say speaking of Flash?
Well, you know, because she's kind of like flashing.
Oh, she's flashing her panties?
Yeah.
Oh, you're horrible.
She's wearing shorts.
They're shorts. So we see Flash and Wonder Woman rushing up to the giants, troll giants trying to stop us. And Wonder Woman's like, Merlin didn't say anything about them. As the... and she's wrong, and she's right to be alarmed, because the one of the troll giants grabs her up and you know, raises her high into the sky. Flash thinks there's only one way to tackle those creatures. What he's going to do is he's going to get them so dizzy that they won't be able to stand up. He spins around them, you know, as they're trying to see him. And sure enough, they get dizzy, and, oh, I'm falling. The wind is spinning us like tops.
The bigger they are.
Go on.
No, I'm just going to leave you hanging there.
The harder they fall, and indeed they do fall.
I'm falling.
Now, as Wonder Woman cleverly thinks to herself, now to quote-unquote wrap up this menace. She's her own biggest fan.
Yeah.
So as the stricken giants lie helpless, Wonder Woman swiftly gathers up some vines and binds them securely. Flash says, good. Meantime, I'll go into the castle where the Trollkin lives. And a moment later, the Crimson Comet, as they have called him, zooms across the castle drawbridge, thinking that it won't take long to overcome the Troll King now that his giants are out of action. But too late does he realize that the portcullis has been dropped right into his path, and he crashes into the you know, the spiked gate on his way to the castle.
Uh-oh.
By the time Wonder Woman reaches the castle, Flash was knocked out and dragged inside the castle. Plain and Wonder Woman. The drawbridge has been raised, so I'll have to devise my own way of getting in.
Oh, I'm sure she'll make her way in.
And she does. What she does is she throws her lasso around, one Merlon of the walkway. See, I'm learning tons of vocabulary here. That's apparently one of the risers on the wall of the castle, the little things that come up, I guess, near where they would shoot from. Huh. So she throws her lasso around one of them and ties it to a tree trunk on the other end, and then basically walks it like a tightrope. Only to find at the very top troll dwarves with Tommy guns. I'm not sure where they draw the distinction between a troll and a dwarf, but long story short, they are tiny little men with machine guns because, as you might remember, they have co-opted the science of our world.
But I gotta say, she's just very lucky that they're only shooting at her wrists.
No, she's so fast that she's moving her wrist to intercept those bullets.
Oh, that's right.
Bullets and bracelets, my friend.
Okay, yeah. I got it.
So she darts in and out and uses her Amazon strength to bend all the Tommy guns into pretzel shapes. Arr. And saying, without them, you'll be helpless. And you'll be out of the way in there. And great Hera, there's the Troll King challenging her. I'm next, Wonder Woman. Do you dare battle with me? There's the little the red-bearded Troll King. So the Mighty Maiden races down a flight of stone steps, and the Troll King pulls a lever. He's tricky, she thinks. I must watch out for a trap. And sure enough, trap it is, because the stairs collapse into a slide, pushing her right into a trap door in the floor. She falls through, and where is she? In prison with the Flash. Flash, the Troll King made you a prisoner here, too. He sure did, says Flash, and now he's turning it into a death cell look, as water starts flooding in from an unforeseen spigot. There's enough room for Flash to get sufficient speed to plow his way through the walls. But Wonder Woman has a clever idea. The walls are so thick, before I could cut through them... Oh, no, I'm sorry. She doesn't have a good idea. She thought she had a good idea to cut through the wall with her tiara, but apparently the walls are so thick that she's not going to be able to do it. Hmm. But Flash has an idea. He begins whirling his arms around and around like the blades of a super fan, faster and faster, setting up a cold wave in the room to freeze the water solid. As Wonder Woman decides it's time for an apt metaphor, she says, just as Niagara Falls freezes over when there's a sudden drop in temperature. And he's like, yes, well, there's time for that later, but vibrate your feet, Wonder Woman, so we can break out of the grip. Oh, so they freeze it, but they themselves freeze, and then he asks Wonder Woman to vibrate super fast so they can break out.
Yeah.
And they do so, and in doing so, then they climb the pillar of ice that's been created. And Wonder Woman uses her Amazon fist to smash through the ceiling, thinking, well, fortunately, the ceiling wasn't as thick as the walls. Flash, the Trollkin, seeking to escape in a helicopter, but no good. She gives a quick flip of her golden lariat, and the evil magician is yanked from the aircraft. As Flash says, good work, Wonder Woman. You caught the Troll King, and I caught the magic incantation. You would think... that, Saturna and the Troll King, they might want to hide those little scrolls, someplace other than on their person.
Yeah.
This actually is not part of the story, but we see on the facing page, one of the things that they would do in the Silver Age to definitely disprove the fact that comic books are contributing to any sort of juvenile delinquency is they would include little educational features to say, look, we're teaching kids stuff. So what we see here is not at all related to the story, but just a page about amazing ratios. So they tell us that, for instance, it would take the heat given off of 1 million gallons of burning gasoline to melt an average-sized iceberg. Or for instance, that a single giant redwood tree can supply enough lumber to build 15 houses. Or in the final gross picture of a close-up of a tongue.
That's pretty nasty.
We see that man has 3,000 taste buds on his tongue, a pig 5,500 and a cow 35,000. Really? Well, maybe taste buds don't relate to they can really discern what's good grass and not. In any case, as I say, just a diversion. Because, more importantly,
Secret of the Sinister Sorcerers, Chapter 4.
That's right. So, to the third and last continent of Magic Land, Oceania. Go, I know you want. Yeah.
Oceania.
That's right. So, yeah. So in Oceania, speeds Superman, Batman, and Aquaman in pursuit of the master magician Simon Magus. Superman is chosen to hunt him down in his floating air castle, Batman to search him out in the Forest Perilous, and Aquaman to seek him out in the depths of the sea. Well, that worked out well. And here you can see a little bit of what I was saying about the art style of Mike Sekowski. You know, he's pretty good at capturing action, but his anatomy just really at times tends to be fairly wonky. I mean, take a, you know, Batman is so barrel-chested in that.
Well, and Superman too. And actually, I have to say, Superman in that particular pose looks a little chunky.
A little child, exactly right. I mean, they all look, yeah,
He
like.
should, if he was longer, I think he might look muscular, but now he kind of looks like in shape, out of shape guy.
Yeah. So some of this might be
Aquaman looks good.
Aquaman looks good, and all, but also, if I could, you know, draw attention, whatever, once again to the coloring, underwater scene, and you know, just a beautiful use of
Yeah.
color to evoke that. But another thing I was going to say about the art is that some of this, you know, I'm placing the burden on Mike Sekowski, but you know what? Some of it might have to do with the inker as well. Bernard Sachs might be contributing some of this too, because I think there's another inker for Mike Sekowski named Joe Giella, I want to say, that we'll see in a little while or whatever. But I really quite prefer that combination to this. This tends to be a little, I don't know, somewhat,
A little much.
yeah, a little much at times. But anyway, back to the story. So our three heroes are, you know, in search of Simon Magus and, you know, air, sea, and land.
Air castle,
Yeah.
floating air castle.
The floating air castle. So, and as Superman nears that floating air castle, he's suddenly cast adrift as air sprites guarding the magician's cloud castle cause a terrific downdraft. It's going to take all of his super strength to break free of it. So with a twist of his mighty hued body, mighty thewed?
I think it says thewed.
Mightily thewed body.
Okay.
He is very prosaic. He rockets out of the typhoon's grip and thinks, since they command the winds and the rains, those air sprites can be dangerous, and no doubt Simon Magus has ordered them to keep away from him. Ah, but it'll take more than the spirits of air to stop Superman, because there's Simon Magus now. To his amazement, however, Superman finds that the closer he gets to the evil mage, the weaker he becomes, thinking, I can't remain aloft. I must land and continue after Simon on foot. What's happening to me? Until he can continue at no greater speed than a stumbling walk. Ha ha ha! I've tricked you, Superman. You see, this is no ordinary throne. It's been carved from a meteor of kryptonite. Kryptonite! My weakness! That explains that Simon Magus has beaten me. Then suddenly the Man of Steel moves forward with all of his super speed. Impossible! You have no superpowers in the presence of Kryptonite. I've learned enough about you, Justice League member. I've learned enough about you, Justice League members, while on Earth to know that much. Nevertheless, grasping the evil magician, Superman hurtles out. He hurtles him out the far wall and away from the clutch of the weakening Kryptonite. I'm afraid I can't take credit for my super speed. Your air sprites were ordered to stop me from grabbing you, so they blew up a whirlwind to snatch me up. That's what propelled me along. Now we'll go meet, huh? Because as you know, even as he's celebrating his victory, Simon Magus disappears right before his eyes. Meanwhile, on land, Batman speeding through the Forest Perilous, unaware that the wood nymphs, or the dryads, are whispering to the very trees themselves. Look at the trees.
Yeah, he looks sort of really surprised.
It's like
like they're telling like shocking secrets.
Yeah, but no, they're humanoid, almost like Wizard of Oz or something, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So Batman's thinking that Simon Magus often takes sanctuary deep in the heart of these woods. He's walking around and he's like, "What?" And he can't move because all of a sudden the trees grab him about you know, all his limbs. You know, they pick him up by his legs and his arms, and they get such a grip on him that he can't even move any more than his fingers. But that might be enough, because what does he make for? His utility belt. And of course, Batman, always prepared, has a capsule for emergencies just like this.
Like cyanide?
Or is cyanide good against trees? I don't know. So he's, oh, so for himself. I have something just for a thing like this. I'll not be torn apart by trees. I'm taking my own life. But no. He snaps the capsule in two and sprays a powerful, or I'm sorry, a powdered lead, which bursts into flames on contact with the air and sends it flying across the branches. As the tree branches burst into flames, they relax their grip on him. and he does not need his cyanide. So, and as the trees frantically beat out their flames, nothing is dreaded so much as in the forest as fire. Batman races on. Simon Magus can't be far from here, and he sights his quarry and makes a flying tackle. Gotcha! But even as he swings a terrible fist to subdue the wizard, once again, wah, 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 his fist goes right through him as Simon Magus fades into thin air. But we've covered air and land, but we have not gone underwater. So at sea, we see Aquaman testing his mental control over sea creatures. Take me to your master, Simon Magus. And, you know, we see some otherworldly sea creatures, you know, a shark of some sort that Aquaman mounts and begins riding like a horse as they respond to his mental commands. So intent is Aquaman on finding the Great Mage that he doesn't even notice that a great net opens up above him and he finds himself caught in its constricting folds. You know, there's Simon Magus dead ahead. You may have control over my creatures, Aquaman, but gaining control over me is another matter. I'll leave you here while I have another try defeating Superman and Batman. Haha, but Aquaman noticed it. Remora fish in these waters. Maybe they can help him out. He mentally orders the Remora leech-like fish, whose clutch has been known to hold ships motionless, to send them toward the magician. And sure enough, ah, I'm caught, I can't move. If you value your life, Simon, you'll pull that lever and free me from this net. The Remora will release you just enough to move your arm. I'm not like Aquaman, I can't stand underwater. I yield, tell them, free my arm. Freed from it, and so Aquaman does so, and then freed from the entangling net, he brings the captive to the shore where Superman and Batman await. Look, Simon Magus didn't disappear on Aquaman as he did with us. Because as ruler of the air, land, and sea, he had three lives. Stopped in the air, he retreated to the land. Defeated on land, he fled to the sea. Defeated there, he was finally forced to surrender. Whew. How convenient. So, when he's forced to surrender, he too must yield up his final piece of the incantation. And they take it. So, and Batman says, let's find the other members and return to Earth.
Okay.
So, slog is almost over. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be judging the story. Judge, jury, and executioner, as you say, you know, it's supposed to be your role. I shall just relate the tale.
Go ahead.
So here we are, finally.
Chapter 5.
At chapter 5, Secret of the Sinister Sorcerers. And, you know, we see the image from the cover, the evil hand coming out of the door.
The golden door.
The golden door. So, their task accomplished.
Sky door.
Sky door, yes. So, their task accomplished. With Saturna, the Troll King, and Simon Magus as their prisoners, the members of the Justice League of America meet at the Golden Doorway to return them to their own world so that Merlin may perform the necessary spell which will undo the evil of the three magicians. Aquaman points, saying, here's the Golden Doorway from magic land back to Earth. When we go through it and give the magic incantation to Merlin, we can put Earth and magic land back into their proper dimensions. What are you laughing at?
Because he's not saying all that. He's merely saying, look, a door.
Yeah. Oh, no. Exposition is huge in these, right? Don't just show when you can show, tell, and tell again. So one by one, each of the great crime fighters springs to the golden doorway, seeking to restrain the strange creature from coming through. Batman says, what puzzles me...
Oh, well, those are different hands from the cover.
Yeah.
On the cover, it was light blue.
Well, yeah, the cover's just a symbolic representation. You know, this is the real deal, Snapper Carr might say.
Snapper Carr.
So what puzzles Batman that is if this doorway leads to Earth, how did such a monster get on Earth? Well, they swapped the magic for the science. Anyway, great is the strength of the Justice League members, but the mighty creature is also powerful, and so... He breaks through, and so this big creature comes all the way through, and Superman says, fine, let it come into Magic Land. Right, our superpowers only work here anyway. And, uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
The big creature starts talking, saying, hey, fellas, don't you know me? Ouch, ouch, cut it out, will you? Great Hera, says Wonder Woman, that voice. And Flash says, it's familiar, even if the rest of the creature isn't. Snapper? What in... Aw, says this giant ogre-looking thing. I was sort of fooling around with Merlin's magic wand, and I guess I goofed somehow and changed myself into this. So I came to find you, hoping you could help me. Oh, he's really dropped the hipster lingo. I'm like, I'm trying to hipster it up, but that's kind of just, he's just talking.
What to do?
So the Justice League returns to a secret meeting place where Merlin's waiting for them, and he casts a spell. Giant, giant, overall, shrink in size, be not so tall. And Martian Manhunter pleads, says Snapper will soon be himself again. And Wonder Woman, wagging a finger at him, says, I hope this teaches you never to meddle in anything you don't understand, Snapper. And Snapper retorts, that's a real hip quip, Wonder Woman. I know the score now, you bet. Snap, snap. So, moments later, Merlin recites the incantation, which restores Earth to its normal science dimension and sends Magicland hurtling into the dimension where only magic works. And his final, Merlin's final spell, worlds in space you shall derange, Earth for magic land exchange. And then, for the last time, the golden doorway serves as a pathway between worlds, with Merlin returning to Magicland with Saturna, the Troll King, and Simon Magus, where he promises that they're going to be properly punished. The doorway fades away into nothingness, and the magician's spell, you can hear the echo of his voice, barely reaching the Justice League, saying, the incantation shall be kept secret by one of my most potent spells, never to trouble you or me again. And we end, and Snapper Carr returning home, looking at his little brother Jimmy with a book of magic tales, saying, come on, Jimmy, I'll read you a story out of this book. Aw, Snapper, stop kidding me. I'm too old to believe there's any such thing as magic. Although, didn't you just spend a week, Jimmy, in a planet where science had stopped working? And So I'm not sure about that. So as Snapper, you know, is offering to read his little brother a tale, let us revisit the point of this podcast, the Parliament of Rooks. I just read you the very first, tale into our exploration of magic and the supernatural in the DC Universe. What is your judgment? What did you think of this story?
The little rook is going to die.
Okay. you didn't like this?
It didn't seem to be very well thought out. I mean, I'm sure as your audience, you know, must have noted, both of us had questions throughout.
Yeah, but bear in mind now, you say not well thought out, and certainly there's gaps in logic, I'll grant you that, you know, but as I say, it was pretty much written for an audience of children, you know.
And I suppose that it's fine for them, but me with my adult eyes and ears, you know, hearing this, and I'm like, it should have been expanded a little bit more. Yeah. And I don't know these characters, and like, these apparently are established characters. Like,
the Justice League themselves and Snapper Carr are established. Merlin is the type of character that, yes, has been represented in DC Comics before, but never with any sort of consistency. Like, he did appear in the Golden Age, he does appear several more times in the Silver Age, but I don't know necessarily that you could always call it the same Merlin. I think he's just sort of a stock character that they revisit. But to your point, though, about, like, you know, the rest of these characters, newly introduced to this story, but in comics, nothing ever dies. As time goes on, we are going to see, deeper into the 1970s, Simon Magus does make a return in World's Finest Comics, and then two of the other baddies, you know, who were not so prominent, the Troll King and Saturna, long time coming, but they actually finally made a resurgence just at the turn of this past century in the early 2000s as supporting characters, I believe, in the Creature Commandos revival. Like I say, nothing is ever lost. One thing I did want to note, though, about the structure, you say not well planned out, but if you're thinking about a juvenile audience, the one thing that this story does have that, you know, is really quite, I think necessary in stories for children is the whole idea of repetition, right? You know, you have, you know, the rule of three, you know, you break it into three parts, three bad guys, two are going to go defeat him. Two are going to go defeat villain number two, and then, you know, the rest are going to go defeat villain number three. And it's very structured like that. Here we have our problem. Here we're going to go break into our teams. Here's solution number one, solution number two, solution number three. We all rejoin for finale. So in that sense, I mean, I think the structure, at least, simple though it may be, you know, is really quite well designed, you know, for its audience. What are your thoughts on that front?
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, clearly it does that, and I think I would expect that on just at a very basic level. You know, I think that a lot of these stories are going to follow suit with that.
At least early on, yeah. But before more mature storytelling techniques come in, yeah, you know, unfortunately, some of these early Silver Age tales are definitely going to be that very sort of rhythmic type thing.
formulaic. Yeah, you know what? I'll grant you that. You know, that is
without the negative connotation. But I mean, like, there, I expect there to be a formula that's followed throughout these books.
There are a handful. Yeah. Before we leave this issue in its entirety, I do want to just back up a couple pages to the letters mail page.
Room.
Yeah, the JLA mailroom or whatever. Because one of the things you might have noticed is, although we know the credits because we went to, you know, comics.org,
mm-hmm.
Normally, you know, at least, you know, at this early part of the Silver Age, they were not, in fact, published in the comic itself. So interestingly, here's a letter to the editor with several questions. And one of the questions he asks, well, first he says that he thinks the new cover was terrific. But by the way, who draws the JLA? We readers would like to know the names of the writers and artists of our favorite magazine. How about it? And, you know, and we jump down and the editor says, the JLA stories are written by Gardner F. Fox, who incidentally created the Justice Society of America, the original All-Star Hero stories from a couple decades ago. So remember mm-hmm. I was telling
right, yeah.
the Golden Age team. And the stories are illustrated by Mike Sikowski, one of the best artists in the comic field. So very interesting. Like I say, you know, very first sort of credit. But now what makes it even more interesting is that this letter is written by an individual named Jerry Bales, who, you know, I think a good deal of my audience will recognize, but Melanie, this man is, you know, would later go on to be known as the father of modern fandom. He spent, you know, a good part of his adult life tracking down the credits for stories, figuring out who wrote them.
Well, that's interesting because here, he's, where is it? Oh, okay, so in a paragraph right below where it says, your new cover is terrific, it says, Snapper Carr is the most, why not make him president of a JLA fan club? So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, in fact, yeah, he says, what's his next thing he says?
I know lots of kids who would like to correspond with each other to promote the JLA.
Yeah, I mean, so believe it or not, that site we went to for the credits, the comics.org,
uh-huh.
he was one of the major contributors. You know, he gathered up, you know, like I said, a lot of this info and then solicited that from a lot of other folks. And then they all collaborated on that. Wow, that's so weird that it says that. Anyway, that clip that out, man. That's or don't because you'll ruin the mint in box or whatever. But no, what an amazing letter. You know, we just happened upon that. So I thought that was worth noting. So to wrap up, Justice League number 2, Judgment Death. is that what I'm doing?
Yeah.
Aww. Well,
I'm sure it'll get better.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hopefully it will because...
Like, I think what it is that, like, my adult eyes are, mm-hmm. are looking at something that's meant for, like, you know, what we say, like, 8 to 12-year-old boy
mm-hmm.
in the early 60s.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of imbalance, you know, at that time.
I think what you're going to find, you know, as we continue through more and more of these stories, that you're actually going to get a fondness, you know, for some of the characters.
I'm sure.
Some of the storytelling technique.
Become more acquainted with them.
Yeah, you're going to have your favorites and so on and so forth. Next time out, we actually, believe it or not, are going to be covering another JLA tale, but a little bit more long-lasting repercussions. You know, some of the characters in this were one-offs. Like I say, you know, you're not going to see Troll King and you know, for another... 50 years. Well, Snapper Carr hangs around for a little while. but no.
I hear he's the most.
The characters that we're going to be introducing next time out are going to be Felix Faust and the Demons 3. You know, definitely a classic JLA villain. And really, I would say, the first major player on the Silver Age, you know, supernatural frontier. So hopefully you're going to dig that a bit more. In any case, thank you everyone for joining us tonight. I hope you had a good time. You know, even though Melanie judged this particular tale, you know, Death from the Parliament, I hope you had a more positive reaction and, you know, we get to live to fly another day. So once again, thank you all and hope to see you again here on Parliament of Rooks.
Take care, everybody.
Bye. That old black magic's got me in its spell.
That old black magic that you weave so well. So welcome, everybody, to the Parliament of Rooks podcast, your guide to all things supernatural in the, what do you call it?
DC Universe.
In the DC Universe. The same old
tingle that I feel inside. What is a Parliament of Rooks?
Yeah, we should explain that.
Well, that phrase actually comes from the old Neil Gaiman series from the...
So, thanks, Neil Gaiman.
Gaiman?
Neil Gaiman. Okay. For you're the lover I have waited for. It's the story with the guy... Cain, right?
Cain, you got it.
Okay. So Cain is from some house. I can't remember what the house is called. The center bird is called the rook. And he caws and crows all night telling his story. And then the birds either peck him to death because his story sucked. Or they fly away.
Well... they're all called rooks. That's the type of bird they are.
You're a rook.
You know, you being more focused on, you know, the...
fantasy end. Fantasy end. You're the lover, you're the lover, you're the lover, you're the lover I
have waited for. You know, I'm reading these stories and she's basically acting as judge.
Yep.
The DC universe as a whole can sort of be divided into what you know they call ages.
Oh yeah.
So you know, like you and I have talked about.
Wait. So having said that, then is Spectre at all connected with like Spectre in the Bond series?
No, not at all. Questions, comments, corrections, and suggestions may be sent to tporpodcast@gmail.com.